On tonight's episode, we're going to talk about stimulant use disorders with Dr. Paxton Bach. But before we get started with that, Natalie, can you please just tell the audience a little bit about what we do on this show?
Sure. So we are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And as a reminder, most of these episodes are available for free CME credit. So you go to VCU Health CE. It's for all health professionals. And you can find more out about that at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And you just have to create an account.
Yeah. And, you know, I just also want to give a very special thanks today to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, because they have really generously partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees. They are committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about their organization at their website, acam.org. And we have a Canadian tonight, Natalie.
Addiction medicine doctors love Canadians. We're always jealous of the Canadians. So it was very exciting to have a Canadian join our podcast.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Well, you know, we have a fantastic guest tonight, Dr. Paxton Bach. He is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of British Columbia and a general internist and addiction medicine physician at St. Paul's in Vancouver, British Columbia. He additionally serves as the co-director for the British Columbia Center on Substance Use and is the director of their Clinical Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. In addition to his clinical and educational roles, Dr. Bach conducts research on the epidemiology and treatment of substance use disorders, with a focus particularly on opioids and stimulants.
And we were so happy that he could join us because he taught us a lot of great things. So we're going to learn about why people use stimulants and why it's really important to talk to your patients about the role that stimulants play in their lives. Also, how to help folks dealing with overamping or uncomfortable symptoms associated with stimulant intoxication. And finally, just a good approach to how you can create a treatment plan for a patient who has stimulant use disorder. So a lot of great pearls in this episode. But without further ado, let's get to it.
Paxton, thank you so much for coming on our show today. So why don't we get started with just a few rapid fire questions so our guests can get to know you a little bit better. So can you please give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Thank you guys so much for having me. Really a pleasure to be here. I'm an internal medicine physician and addiction medicine doctor in Vancouver, British Columbia, although I did have the opportunity to live briefly in Los Angeles. I'm born and raised in British Columbia, and I live here with my wife and my two young children. I have two very young children, so don't have a lot of time for hobbies these days, but I still try and get outside when I can and live the British Columbia life. And, you know, I like hiking and fishing and spending time out on the water when I get those opportunities. So they're few and far between these days, but every now and then we can steal a moment.
Thank you. And can you tell us, what are your favorite aspects of working in the field of addiction medicine? What brings you to this work and what do you like about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's obviously a field that I'm passionate about. I think the biggest things are, one, that it's important. I think that we have an opportunity to, there's a real need, there's a real lack of providers working in this sphere, and there's an opportunity to really help people. But more than anything, I think it's the people themselves. I love working with my patients. I love my colleagues. I love the interdisciplinary teams that I work with. I think it's just such a fantastic mix of people who are really passionate about what they do. And I think that that makes all the difference.
So Natalie, you know, why don't we actually start with a case to start help ground the topic and let folks sort of learn more. So please, why don't you take us to our first case from Cashlack Memorial?
Sure. So Mr. J is a 36-year-old gentleman who's brought in by EMS with acute anxiety and paranoia. And they report that a friend at the scene suspected he was overamping on methamphetamine. He is unable to participate meaningfully in the interview or exam, but the triage nurse reports his heart rate is elevated at 130. He has dilated pupils, diaphoresis, and agitation. When you try to go in to introduce yourself, he is pacing restlessly in the exam room, yelling at staff that they are out to get him. So it's difficult to kind of complete an interview. So just to kind of start off our conversation broadly, can you tell us a bit about what are common stimulants, What do they do for people? Why do people use stimulants?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, stimulants as a category is a pretty broad one. I think it encompasses everything from caffeine to cathinones and everything in the middle. But for the purposes of our conversation today, and I think a lot of times, at least in North America, we're typically referring to two things, and that's usually cocaine and methamphetamine. Those tend to be by far the most common stimulants that we see, at least in my setting and in many settings, in terms of frequency of problematic use and kind of the amount of time that they present to care. Cocaine, I think most people are somewhat familiar with, comes in different forms. So there's powdered cocaine or the cocaine salt. And then an alternative form is crack cocaine or the cocaine base, which is more solid in its form. And they can be used differently. Really, it kind of comes down to their water solubility. I think that's one of the defining features. So powdered cocaine, very water soluble, lends itself well to insufflation or snorting, and can also mix easily with water and is a more common form of injected cocaine. Whereas crack cocaine smokes very easily. It sublimates at low temperatures, and so it's most commonly seen in smoking. Methamphetamine, similar drug in terms of its actual mechanism of action, another common stimulant, and really I think the dominant stimulant in my workplace, at least over the last decade. Methamphetamine or amphetamines in general also come in different forms. We almost exclusively see crystal meth where I work. So there are amphetamine salts. There's also amphetamine bases and the crystal form. The crystal form is by far the most dominant one that I see. Again, very water soluble, lends itself very well to insufflation or snorting, and lends itself well to injection. People smoke it very easily. Some people even swallow it or parachute it, and others, booty bumping or hooping or going PR with methamphetamine is another potential route that I think I see less of, but in certain groups is more popular. And in my context, when people are using these substances, they'll usually say that they either snort them, would be the most common term for insufflation, that they shoot them, would be the most common term for an injection here, or sometimes fixing would be referring to injection use. Hooping or booty bumping would both refer to PR use, so dissolving the meth or the powdered cocaine in water and going PR with it. Parachuting would be another one that I hear occasionally, and that's people who swallow it orally. I'd say a less common route of administration for crystal meth, but certainly one that's used sometimes. And then most people just call smoking.
And just as a kind of background, something that as addiction doctors, I think is important for us to recognize is that people often use drugs because it provides them some benefit in their lives. Like their perception is it helps them in some way, So what are the reasons that people use stimulants, or what are the reasons that people, your patients usually tell you that they use stimulants?
So I think that's such a critical question. So I really appreciate that question, because I think you're right. And, across the entire spectrum of substance use, people use for different reasons, or at least often start using for different reasons, and that may evolve over time. I find that with stimulants in particular, although that's really at the crux of putting together a treatment plan, and when somebody presents with a stimulant use disorder, or really understanding kind of what role stimulants play in somebody's life, because you see such a variety of patterns. You'll see people use daily, intermittently. They'll go on benders with long periods of absence in the middle. So you see sporadic use. There's such a variety of patterns, and oftentimes it does come down to why people are using and what role that the drug is playing in their life. Just to take a step back and talk a little bit about the substances themselves before we get into that, and the effects that one gets from stimulants. Both cocaine and methamphetamine have a pretty similar mechanism of action. Cocaine is a monoamine neurotransmitter reuptake inhibitor, which is a fancy way of saying that it prevents the reuptake of monoamine neurotransmitters like norepinephrine, like serotonin, like dopamine. It prevents their reuptake, so they get to hang around in the synapse longer, do their thing for longer, and promote feelings of alertness and euphoria, concentration, and can really have some positive effects for people in terms of functioning in their life, whether that's surviving on the streets or doing better at work or for concentration at school, etc. Methamphetamine pretty similar in its mechanism of action. It also prevents that reuptake at the synapse of the same neurotransmitters, but it goes one step further than that, and it actually promotes efflux as well. So it promotes the synthesis and efflux of these transmitters into the synapse, so you get this incredible surge of dopamine, of norepinephrine, of serotonin, and you know, the effects that follow, which again can range from everything from euphoria and alertness all the way to more concerning symptoms like the ones you described in your case here, including your chest pain, palpitations, insomnia, agitation, anxiety, all the way out to frank psychosis. So circling back to your question, I think understanding why people use is really critical. And you will hear, and everyone will tell you a different story. Some common stories that I hear include people using for concentration to self-medicate, you know, ADHD or other mental health issues. I'll hear a lot of people who use it to offset other substances. So that maybe opioids would be their primary substance of drug of choice, and they'll use methamphetamine to offset that. Survival is a really common one. I work with a pretty street and fringe population, and just surviving on the streets, staying up at night so you don't get robbed or so you can make it through the night, I think is another really common story that I hear. I see a lot of patients who use it was very closely linked to sex and their sex lives. So you know, there are many, many different stories out there, but without understanding that, I think that any discussion on treatment options, I think you're putting the cart before the horse, so to speak.
That's really helpful. So the case that we talked about, you like it's called overamping, or like you were saying, sometimes you can have these extreme kind of ends of stimulant reaction. So what are the symptoms of stimulant intoxication like, and how do you treat it? How would you treat this patient who came into the ED?
Sure. So two sort of questions there. Stimulant intoxication, as I mentioned, there's a spectrum. So it can range from alertness and euphoria, a positive mood, improved concentration, all the way to more concerning presentations, hypertension, hyperthermia, palpitations, chest pain, seizures, paranoia, frank psychosis, and everything in the middle. Again, all symptoms of just this incredible surge of norepinephrine and of dopamine, of serotonin, and of all these neurotransmitters. The term that you used here is an interesting one, because that's overamping is something that we'll hear sometimes. Well, people will refer to overamping on stimulants. And I'm curious, you know, again, I think this is a term that doesn't have a clear definition, at least to me. I know what it means to me. I'm curious what in each of your respective practices that refers to. I would say in my experience, overamping is sort of the stimulant equivalent of an overdose, but it's not quite as discrete as an opiate overdose. You know, it's not cessation of breathing. So I think it typically refers to when people are starting to experience uncomfortable symptoms from taking stimulants, taking too much or taking them for too long. But that's a little subjective. You know, for some people, palpitations may be quite uncomfortable, quite anxiety provoking, and may lead them to present to the ED. And for others, that's just part of using crystal meth. So I think it's a little harder to draw a clear box around. But to me, it's that, you know, it's hypertension, it's palpitations, it's discomfort, anxiety, paranoia, kind of all of those uncomfortable symptoms that might come when somebody is, again, often using too much or for too long. But like I said, I'm curious what you guys would see and what that term means to you.
Same here. It's complicated. There's a part that's subjective, and I've heard it used in a variety of different ways. So I think in my practice, what I really try and do is clarify and ask, what does that mean to the patient? Because again, people use it in different ways, and I want to make sure that I'm understanding like the symptoms and what's really causing them to like feel uncomfortable, so we can sort of think about different ways to minimize that risk in the future. And again, it's really a spectrum. As you said, it can be something more like, I'm just feeling tired and I don't feel good. I had a seizure, you know, I was having chest pain and maybe was having a coronary vasospasm. So I think it's really important that we like ask our patients what that term means to them. And I'm curious, Paxton, in your practice, can you take us through? We understand now that overamping is really kind of a spectrum. It often means a spectrum of sort of symptoms. So what symptoms do you most commonly see in the hospital setting, for example, where you would really want to start treating that individual?
So I do primarily work in a hospital, and I spend a lot of time in the emergency room. So this is certainly a presentation that is familiar to me. I think that, again, there is a bit of a spectrum here. Most commonly, I think when people present to hospital specifically due to a stimulant intoxication, they're describing symptoms like the ones in this vignette. So maybe some anxiety, agitation, some paranoia, discomfort, potentially palpitations, etc. But they're still able to, there's still insight there, and they're able to have a conversation with you and to a certain extent describe, you know, what they're feeling and what's happened, and there's still that insight that's there. In that scenario, I think the treatment is primarily conservative and supportive. Really, it's about just, you know, talking to somebody calmly, quietly, finding a low stimulation environment as best as you can in an emergency room, which is not always easy to do, but trying to find a quiet corner or a darker room or a private space to put somebody, dim lights, cool compresses, really kind of trying to again speak calmly, softly, and just make them feel comfortable, and really just try and de-escalate as much as possible and let them rest. And for a patient like the one described here, as often as not, if you're able to do that and really just sort of make them feel comfortable, potentially have somebody with them who they're comfortable around, and really just try and prevent that overstimulation, that alone can be a really effective way of managing it, this scenario. Give them some water, give them a cool compress, just do what we can to give them some space to kind of come down. Certainly, that doesn't work all the time. And for people who are particularly agitated or particularly uncomfortable, I think the standard would probably be benzodiazepines for management in that scenario. So, you know, take your pick, lorazepam or midazolam, just small doses of benzos to, again, just help not, we don't want to see anyone snowed on benzos, but just help them be comfortable, take care of that anxiety, keep them comfortable. And again, just give them a quiet place to kind of rest and recover. That would be really, there's no magic to it. That's all that it usually takes to manage a patient such as the one that you're describing here. I think, you know, for completeness, it's important to also recognize that some people present with less of an agitation picture and more with frank psychosis, where that insight is gone. There's lots of paranoia, delusions, and that's certainly a more complicated presentation. One, because teasing out whether that is specifically due to the stimulant use versus an underlying mental health disorder is not an easy task. And two, the management itself is much more nuanced. I would suggest if that's the case to involve a psychiatrist in and manage that together. Because it may or may not involve the use of antipsychotics, and figuring out what the appropriate disposition for somebody is and follow-up care is all pretty high level, I would say. So that's a scenario where I would certainly involve my colleagues in psychiatry to help co-manage.
Great. So just to summarize that, it sounds like for a lot of individuals who are presenting with acute stimulant intoxication, we can manage it and the ER by sort of just trying to minimize the stimulation, finding a nice quiet room. And for individuals who are a little bit agitated, you could try some benzodiazepines such as lorazepam. And for individuals who may be coming in with really quite a bit of acute psychosis at that time, it's probably a good time to call your psychiatry colleagues to sort of help with that management.
Yeah, precisely. And if there's one thing I can... Please try and avoid things like restraints, and you know, that's only going to escalate the situation. I think that the amount of times it's actually required is exceptionally small. Again, just a quiet room and a calm voice is often all that really takes.
So back to our case, Mr. J, he does end up requiring a couple doses of lorazepam to help him, and he sleeps for most of the following day. His urine comes back positive for methamphetamine and fentanyl. And when he does wake up, he tells you he's just feeling really exhausted and sad. He states that he's been using methamphetamine for about 4 years and that he's been spending hundreds of dollars per week, and that his use has really caused quite a few problems with work and his family. And over time, he's had to use quite a bit more to have the same effect. He often has trouble coming down or sleeping, and sometimes he may use dope to help with this, but he unfortunately had an overdose recently and is aware that the opioid supply is predominantly fentanyl. He's really tried to cut down on his use, but hasn't succeeded. And whenever he stops, he feels really depressed and unable to get out of bed. So you determine, based on his history, you know, that he meets criteria for severe stimulant use disorder, as he meets 7 out of the 11 DSM-5 criteria. And he states, you know, doc, I really want treatment. So how would you approach developing a treatment plan for his stimulant use disorder?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, a great question. Really sounds like he's ticking a lot of those boxes. I'll just point out the feelings of exhaustion and sadness and maybe dysphoria that he's feeling. I think stimulants, often we don't pay enough attention to withdrawal phenomenon from stimulants, because it's not quite as pronounced as withdrawal from things like opioids or alcohol. You know, the withdrawal from those substances is very much in your face. So you often hear people say that, you know, you don't really get withdrawal from stimulants. That's I think a common narrative that I do hear. And that's clearly not the case. And that's certainly sounds like what he's describing here is stimulant withdrawal, which can be really distressing, can be really prolonged, and can be really hard to treat, and is often, in my experience, one of the reasons that people go back to stimulants, because they just feel just generally lousy, and that can last for days or even weeks at a time. So just an observation there. You know, before I answer your question, I suppose, you know, again, I work in a context with a lot of opioid use and a lot of overdoses, so I'll seize on the fact that he is using opioids sometimes, and I would want to explore that with him a little bit more. If that's an intermittent, periodic thing that's used just to offset those symptoms of methamphetamine use is one thing, but I'd really want to make sure that one, he doesn't necessarily meet criteria for an opioid use disorder, and we shouldn't be stopping him with agonist therapy, and two, really talk about safety there. Couldn't move on in this conversation without pointing that out, because it's just so dangerous out there right now. But that's not the focus of today's session, so we'll against my all
no,
of my
we, insta- we like these yeah. pearls, we like these tips, because that's the truth, yeah. Right, many of our patients use multiple substances, you know, and they may not have a use disorder with all of them, but mixing does create, you know, like additional risks, and it's important to address it.
A lot of the people, you know, a lot of people are dying of overdoses who don't primarily use opioids now. And, you know, so something that I've been trying to talk about with trainees more is saying, if someone uses cocaine, you need to be talking to them about overdose risk. You need to be offering them naloxone. Like, if people are using stimulants, they need to be handed naloxone, because especially people who have less tolerance with the unpredictability of our supply, the overdose risk has been getting so much higher. So people think about naloxone for opioid users, and like, no. Like, these people need to have that conversation too. It might be even like equally important. So I really appreciate the point you made.
And if you're watching Natalie in person, I know when she like really wants to emphasize something, because she brings her hand to her face and does this little wave. So viewers out there, this is important. Folks who use stimulants should receive naloxone to prevent overdoses.
Took the words right out of the mouth. Our drug checking data is actually pretty public and pretty granular in BC. And up to 5% of the stimulants checked here on a monthly basis have fentanyl in them. So when you consider, you know, that when people are using stimulants, they're using many times per day, that's shocking. You know, that's very scary. So 100% agree.
We got derailed because we had such an important point to make. So back to the original thing, just like, what is your treatment approach for folks with stimulant use disorders?
So when we're talking to this fellow about a stimulant use, I'll take it back again to that point I made initially. I think of it in three discrete stages or three discrete discussions that we need to have. The first of those is, again, related to understanding the role of stimulants in his life and who this fellow is. I think addressing things like comorbidities, be those physical or mental health comorbidities, and social determinants of health is critical. Again, if I'm seeing a patient who is homeless or vulnerably housed, and they use crystal meth to survive at night in their shelter, then me suggesting some psychosocial treatment of them for the treatment of their stimulant use disorder is at best probably missing the point, and at worst insulting. So I think, again, so that's a starting place, is understanding where somebody's coming from. Again, social determinants of health, other comorbidities, and what we can address there. That's not, again, the focus of today's talk, but people use stimulants for reasons, and if we don't understand those reasons and try and address them, then we're barking up the wrong tree. So that would be the starting place, I think, for this conversation, and seeing whether I have any ability to, whether that does play into his use or not, because it may not, whether I have any ability to help at least refer him to services to help with those other things. One of the more important pieces, I think, but again, not really, you know, in terms of the value that I can bring as a physician, the next two things that I talk about where I can actually maybe intervene more directly are pharmacologic treatments and non-pharmacologic treatments. And again, I think this is a framework you can apply for any substance. You know, there's social determinants of health, comorbidities, everything that's going on in somebody's life. And then there's what can I provide in terms of pharmacologic treatments and non-pharmacologic treatments or supports. And those are two distinct conversations. So that's probably the most appropriate place to start then in terms of those other two conversations. I think that, you know, I'm an internist and I like to prescribe medications. I think it's pretty firmly hammered into us by this point in our training or our practice. But I can't overemphasize the fact that psychosocial treatments remain the gold standard for treating stimulant use disorder. They're clearly the best evidence and most effective strategies that we have, and they're generally quite unavailable, which is really disappointing. And that's because, you know, our system in Canada, much like your system in the US, tends to favor medications or things that we can, you know, more clearly measure or draw a box around. So psychosocial treatments is certainly where the conversation should start and is definitely the gold standard in terms of efficacy. As you are all aware, there's a huge breadth of things out there under that umbrella term of psychosocial treatments. And if there's any single one that I think we really should highlight for the purposes of this podcast as again, the clear gold standard in the treatment of stimulant use disorder, whether that's cocaine or crystal meth, it's something called contingency management, which is, truthfully, as an internist, before I got into addiction, not anything that I had any previous exposure to. It's not something that I think we talk about a lot in other settings, even though there is data for it outside the substance use world.
For those who are listening who haven't heard of contingency management, can you break down for us a little bit more about what that treatment looks like?
Absolutely. So contingency management it's really simple in its premise. It's based on the ideas of operant conditioning. Or, you know, essentially of providing rewards for people who are achieving their goals or you know, achieving the behavior changes that they're striving towards. And while it's not, you know, a concept that I'd ever really heard about directly during my internal medicine training, on reflection, I think we've all been contingency managed all through our life. At so many points in our life, right? Everything from gold stars when you were a kid for cleaning your room to, you know, whatever your iPhone, like all your apps on your iPhone are all designed to, again, provide you with immediate small rewards to promote behavior change. And that's really what it's all about. It's providing immediate rewards to reinforce behaviors that hopefully you're setting out those goals or those behaviors collaborative with your patient. So for the purposes of treating stimulant use disorder, there's a few different kind of paradigms that are described, but typically what it might look like is you'll set goals within a program, and that may be abstinence from a substance. You know, that's a very common one that's especially in the literature, but doesn't necessarily have to be the only one that you set. It could be a reduction in use, it could be meeting other health goals, it could be just showing up, it could just be attendance and retention. So you'll set those goals, or those goals will be set within the framework of this program. And when you achieve those goals, there are rewards that are associated with it. The two most common ways those rewards are sort of doled out are either increasing incrementally over time as you continue to meet whatever goals there are, reduction in use or cessation of use, for instance. Or I think more commonly, at least in my world, is what's called a fishbowl approach. In other words, you get draws from a prize bowl. And so our contingency management programs that we have here at St. Paul's Hospital, you can draw from a prize bowl. You get a number of draws depending on, again, the goals that you set and what week you are in the program, and you can draw vouchers for $5, or there's $5 vouchers. If there's less $20 vouchers, there's even less $100 vouchers, and you get those rewards, which are not meant to be commensurate with the degree of work that you're putting into this behavior change, but they're just those reminders. They're things to work for, and there's those reminders. And we're, you know, human beings, we're funny creatures. We respond to, well, to that kind of those kind of rewards. You know, again, I'll go back to gold stars when you were cleaning your room as a kid.
I think in the contingency management that I've seen too, one of the powerful parts has been you have people to talk to about what happened and if you have any goals or what you might do, what might be different next time. So I think that that part too, saying like someone wants to see you every week and talk about it and regardless of, and celebrate your successes and help you if you've been struggling. And I think that that's been a part of it that's been, seemed great for me to observe when I've been able to observe it. And it's really unfortunate that it's so hard to kind of fund and get access to for our patients because it's, our current mechanisms are not always supportive of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it goes without saying it has to be a safe space, and those goals need to be established sort of collaboratively. It doesn't help for me to tell somebody what they must be aiming for. But you're right. I think that, you know, one of our programs here is a group program, and it's once a week, and the participants, they all get to know each other, and they're all there to support each other. And so, you know, if somebody draws the $100 prize, everyone's cheering, everyone's excited. Like, there's very much a community to it. So I think that those intangibles, and really, again, making it just a safe, non-threatening, comfortable space to come back to, whether or not you're meeting your goals, whether whatever's happening in your life is, I think that's a theme that extends well beyond contingency management programs, is, you know, pretty critical to the practice of, I wouldn't even say addiction medicine, I would say medicine, I hope, as a whole. I would like to hope.
Yeah, and the little bit of contingency management that I've had the opportunity to participate in, it's fun. It's great. As you said, it's this huge sort of team sport where you get to cheer for everybody, and everybody often like feels good at the end because we've created this like really supportive environment. And I'm curious, you know, like I wasn't exposed to it either until I was in my fellowship. And what do you tell folks, Paxton, who hear this idea, right? We're going to pay folks to have, you know, like negative urines. Some folks may feel opposed to that. What do you tell sort of naysayers of contingency management?
Yeah, that's a common criticism that comes up. I mean, and all I can really point at is again, just the evidence in helping promote this behavior change. The number needed to treat for contingency management programs for stimulant use disorder, depending on where you look and what outcome you're measuring, is between 3 to 5. That is phenomenal, right? There's very few, if any, find me a medication in internal medicine other than OAT that has an NNT that's that good. It's phenomenally effective, and it's so easy, right? And this is the thing that really always frustrates me, is that we are happy to invest so much money into medications and to all the, you know, to much more, you know, fancier treatments or investigations. Contingency management, you need a room, you need a facilitator. It can be a doctor, a nurse, a peer, a social worker. You need a handful of prizes. It's very cheap. It's very easy to get off the ground. And yet it's widely unavailable. Partly, I think, again, because we tend to value medications in our systems, but also partly because of that objection that people have to this idea that you're paying people. And I can't devote a lot of time to that, because I just think it's the evidence is very clear that this is the most effective treatment we have for stimulant use disorder, full stop. And there needs to be more access. We actually have a program which we run for inpatients in our hospital. So we set one up for inpatients who are admitted for prolonged stays within the hospital itself, who are using stimulants and want help cutting back or stopping. So we'll start it there in the hospital and transition them to our outpatient program when they get discharged, if they're interested. And then they can remain in it for up to 12 weeks at a time. So, you know, we've tried to make it available in our setting, but again, it's criminally unavailable in most places. I will say, in the US, credit to the VA, I understand that that's probably the largest rollout of contingency management that I'm aware anywhere in the world. It's nice to see it embraced there. And I know that there's been a lot of talk recently in California about changes to Medicaid regulations there, allowing them to fund these programs and piloting them more broadly. So I think it's great. I can't wait to see more real world data.
That's incredible that you were able to implement that in your hospital. Absolutely, absolutely amazing. Big fan of contingency management. We definitely need more of it. And just for folks too, you used a term just called OAT. I just want to remind the audience that stands for opioid agonist like treatment, which may be something like methadone or buprenorphine, naloxone.
And has a similar low NN number needed to treat. So sometimes people ask us, isn't addiction medicine a depressing field? And we're like, no, we have awesome patients and we have the best number needed to treat. of almost anyone else. So come to addiction medicine because it is a great, there's treatments that work once we can get them to people. So I think that's, I didn't know that the number needed to treat for contingency management was actually that low. So I learned a new thing.
And on that note, so if you had to start reaching in now into your medication bag, you know, what sort of medication treatments would you offer patients for their stimulant use disorders?
Yeah. So I think just as one aside for completeness, I should mention other psychosocial treatments, you know, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, which the evidence is certainly less solid around programs like CBT, but still other options that could be considered and that some people do find in my clinical experience to be really helpful. So contingency management is not the only psychosocial treatment, but I think it is by far the best and most consistently evidenced one. But to your question, moving into pharmacologic treatments, I think that's where, you know, that is where I gravitate. I am an internist. I can't help myself but want to think about and talk about the medications. I should again preface this conversation by pointing out that it's not an either or, and we certainly can combine in terms of pointing out solid evidence for the combinations of psychosocial treatments and pharmacologic treatments. There's not really that good data there in the treatment world for stimulant use disorder, but in my clinical practice, and I think just there's no reason why these things can't necessarily be combined, so they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. But the conversation around pharmacologic treatments, I think, really begins with the idea that is quite pervasive out there that we have no medications to treat stimulant use disorders. That is the most common bottom line that you will hear, which is it's not wrong. Well, I'm going to say it's wrong. it's certainly an oversimplification. We have no medications that are FDA approved. We have no medications that you know consistently across large numbers of trials show significant benefits. That is true, but that is not to say that we don't have. There's not evidence out there that suggests that certain medications might be helpful in certain situations. One of my issues with that interpretation of the literature is not only that I disagree with it, but I think that the literature around treatment of stimulant use disorder is challenging to interpret, and that's for a few reasons. There are lots of studies out there that you can look at trying lots of different medications, especially for cocaine use and more recently for amphetamine use and methamphetamine use, but the whole field is plagued by a few significant issues. Many, many trials out there, but they all tend to be quite small. So they're all, you know, of a fairly low power to begin with, if not already underpowered. They all set very ambitious primary outcomes, which is almost universally abstinence, which is not necessarily what many of my patients are searching for, and is certainly a high bar to set for a small trial. They also tend to have very high rates of attrition. Lots of dropout. It's not uncommon to see 40% of people drop out of a trial for stimulant use disorder, which, you know, makes it very hard to draw significant conclusions from. And even if two people do remain in the trial, adherence to the study medication or the intervention is also often quite low. So and there's often a pretty significant placebo effect noted in many of these trials. So there's a variety of reasons why the literature is maybe more challenging to interpret. And I think that it is an oversimplification to just write it off as saying there's nothing there. We just have to look a bit harder. When we do that, I think there are a number of medications that have a good safety profile and enough evidence out there that they are worth considering.
Can you walk us through some of the medications that you prefer to use in your practice?
Absolutely. So, you know, I talked in the beginning about the fact that cocaine and methamphetamine have pretty similar mechanisms of action, and they do. And so depending on where you're looking, some studies may look at one, the other, or a combination of both. So that's already one of the kind of wrinkles in trying to work our way through this literature. But I think there's a few medications out there that either have had consistent signals across a number of trials, or at least one really well-conducted trial that showed a benefit. And there's a couple of medications that I would highlight to think about. Again, in my world, I'm treating mostly people who use crystal meth. That's by far the most common stimulant that I'm seeing. So I'll start with those ones because they tend to be the ones that I think about the most. So probably the first medication that I think is worth thinking about, because it was one of the earlier trials that came out for treatment of crystal meth that was, you know, generally very well done. It was a replication of a smaller pilot study, and it was quite large and well conducted. It was a 2019 trial done in San Francisco with the primary the PI on that was Philip Coffin. The study medication that they used was mirtazapine. And so again, this was based off of a previously published study of theirs, which showed a benefit in a small group. So this is a replication study published in 2019 with a larger group where they treated them with 30 milligrams of mirtazapine daily for 24 weeks, long study period. And they showed a very significant benefit of mirtazapine in achieving, again, abstinence at 24 and also at 36 weeks, even after the medication itself had completed. So mirtazapine 30 milligrams once daily, a medication we all know, it's generally safe, and it showed a significant benefit in this single site study for achieving abstinence from crystal meth use. I need to point out that this study was conducted exclusively among cisgendered men who have sex with men or transgender women who have sex with men, so that is one question about generalizability that many have. It's not necessarily clear whether or not this would apply elsewhere, and it was a single site. But I think it's really a medication worth thinking about because we all know it. It's relatively safe and tends to be well tolerated, in particular if you are seeing somebody who might fit within the profile of the study population that they use there. I think mirtazapine is certainly something to consider. So that was just in 2019, a relatively recent publication and one of the first large studies that actually I think really made people think that there might actually be potential out there for medications. So that would be one that I would say file away to think about. More recently than that, just last year, it was 2021, I believe, a large trial came out called ADAPT-2, which you guys may be familiar with, which I think really, really opened the door here for treatment of methamphetamine use disorder, because our cupboard was pretty bare in terms of treatments prior to this. So this was a large multi-site trial across the U.S., very well conducted, very, very experienced clinical trialists involved, looking at a combination of extended-release naltrexone and oral bupropion in combination. So they showed over 12 weeks with fairly high doses of bupropion, 450 milligrams daily, and a slightly higher frequency of injections for the naltrexone. It was Q3 weeks. They showed a very significant benefit. Again, a number needed to treat here of about 9, for abstinence from crystal meth. So again, setting a high bar and meeting it. And this was amongst, you know, this population, 30% of them had a history of IV meth use. Almost all of them used daily. It was not necessarily they were treatment seeking adults, but they weren't cherry picked. They were people with pretty severe methamphetamine use disorders. So I think that trial remains as far as a single trial, the best evidence we have out there for the treatment of methamphetamine use disorder. Caveats to that one. Well, for me, extended release naltrexone is not available in Canada. It's not approved here. So that really throws a wrench in my plans. Most common follow-up question is, could we just try high dose PO naltrexone and see if we can get away with it? And, you know, I don't see why not, but that is one of the big limitations for me. The other real potential limitation for this trial is that, again, at least in my setting and in many settings in the U.S., we're seeing a ton of crystal meth use these days in combination with opioids. So obviously, if somebody is using opioids and methamphetamine together, the option of extended-release naltrexone, I wouldn't say it's off the table, but in all comers, I think that we tend to not, that tends to not be our go-to for treatment of opioid use disorder. So I think that that's a decision that needs to be weighed carefully, because it would obviate our ability to use our more traditional medications like methadone or buprenorphine. So that is the unfortunate big drawback for that study, at least in my setting, because that's, you know, almost exclusively what I see is combination use.
Yeah, and here I would say we also have the barriers of insurance companies. So in the United States, trying to convince an insurance company to pay for what is a relatively expensive medicine if there's no, you know, FDA approval for it. I have not been successful. I'm able to prescribe it for alcohol use disorder, opioid use disorder, but I've never been successful in getting it covered strictly for stimulant use disorder, unfortunately. So
the last medication then that I think is worth talking about, and this is generally the one that gets the most attention and generates the most discussion, is psychostimulants. So prescribed psychostimulants, whether that's things like dextroamphetamine or Adderall or methylphenidate or modafinil even, that's a broad category. But the most common question that I get from patients as well as other providers is whether we can do something, you know, analogous to opioid agonist therapy with long-acting psychostimulants for the treatment of stimulant use disorder. And that is a very interesting rabbit hole for us to go down. So I'll try and provide a really quick overview here, because I think we could talk about this for an hour, but it's, you know, it's something that mechanistically I think is really attractive, the idea, especially in a fellow like you're describing in this vignette, who's complaining of very significant physical withdrawal, physical cravings. You know, can we treat that with a prescribed predictable dose of a slow release psychostimulant, much like we would opioid withdrawal? And it's been tried many, many times. There's many, many, many trials looking at a variety of psychostimulants in a variety of settings. Again, all of which are plagued by many of the issues which I highlighted up front. There's very few trials that are outright positive, and they tend to be dwarfed by the negative trials. There are a couple here and there that have showed a positive effect, but by and large, we haven't seen a consistent effect in any one study. A really thought-provoking meta-analysis came out about 2 years ago on this subject, though, that I think got everyone thinking. There have been a number of meta-analyses looking at treatments for cocaine use disorder, a number of meta-analyses looking at treatment for methamphetamine use disorder. Dextroamphetamine and methylphenidate always come out with an asterisk. They can never be recommended in these meta-analyses, but the authors are always careful to point out there might be something there. A very interesting meta-analysis came out about 2 years ago by a guy named Vitor Tardelli out of Brazil, who took a different approach. He took all prescribed psychostimulants, rather than looking at them individually and looking at pooling methylphenidate trials, pooling dextroamphetamine trials, etc. He'd put all trials together with both dextroamphetamine, with methylphenidate, with Adderall, or combined amphetamine salts, and even included modafinil. So pooled all of the psychostimulants together and looked at all trials for both cocaine and methamphetamine together as well. So any prescribed psychostimulant for the treatment of stimulant use disorder as a whole. So that approach had never been taken before. No one's tried that. And it generated really thought-provoking results. The bottom line to that meta-analysis is that they found a significant benefit in achieving abstinence for prescription psychostimulants in the treatment of stimulant use disorder. Full stop. Number needed to treat there was 16. So that was really, really exciting, I think, for a lot of people and generated a lot of discussion. When you get into the nitty-gritty of that study, a few things come out that are important to bear in mind. Almost all of the signal effect that they saw was in trials focused on cocaine use disorder rather than methamphetamine use disorder. So that really is where the majority of the effect comes when you look at those forest plots. Part of the reason might be that 3/4 of the patients enrolled in this or included in this meta-analysis were from cocaine use disorder trials. There's just more data to pull off of there, but certainly the data does look more compelling in that population compared to those who use methamphetamine or crystal meth. Similarly, when you start to break down the individual psychostimulants, it's actually dextroamphetamine and amphetamine salts like Adderall that come out looking the most promising. And they also looked at low doses versus high dose. And I think this is based on my clinical experience, that's really the key there, is that trying these medications at 20 or 30 milligrams daily, I've never seen any benefit from it. And that's in this study, the threshold beyond which benefit was really seen was 60 milligrams, which is a pretty high dose of dextroamphetamine for those of us who are, you know, used to prescribing it in a very different context. But I think that it's, you know, physiologically, it's pretty, that there's a pretty strong rationale to believe that that might be the case. And I can say in my practice, and I have tried this, you know, many times with some success, not overwhelming success, but I'd say that when I do tend to see success, it is with higher doses. The last thing that I should highlight, because I think it's also really important to keep in mind, these are generally safe medications, and the safety profile in all these trials, even at these high doses, was good, but they excluded patients with significant history of cardiovascular disease or psychiatric disease. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, because those are comorbidities that I come up against often. And so, you know, weighing those risks and benefits, you're kind of operating in a bit more of an evidence-free zone in those patients. And so it's a more collaborative decision, I would say.
And for the primary care docs out there, you know, listening, I think it's really important. You may or may not feel comfortable using these medications in your practice, but I do think it's really important to know that there is evidence-based treatment out there, and that really connecting patients to like addiction treatment and addiction services, so they have the potential, you know, to really work with an expert who can sort of weigh these risks versus benefits in a monitored setting. It's important to know, because, you know, when I was in training, I as a resident, this just didn't come up. I wasn't seeing this or hearing of this. And if I had known what I know now, right, I would have been on the lookout for like what facilities, which doctors in my area are able to offer these treatments to my patients.
The other part is of that is that, like you were talking about earlier, there are patients who identify as maybe were diagnosed as having ADHD as children, or really feel like stimulant use helps them get through their day or do things. I see amongst my colleagues a lot of different levels of comfort with the idea of using psychostimulants to treat stimulant use disorder, but I think many of us have had patients who had prior or clear diagnosis of ADHD, and when they were treated with like appropriate doses of stimulants, did feel like they did have significant reduction in their use. So I think saying, even if you're not wanting to use it kind of off-label to treat stimulant use disorder, saying you're going to use it on-label to appropriately treat ADHD and not let the history of stimulant use make you more afraid to give your patient evidence-based treatment, I think that's also a piece to kind of keep in mind, is that that could also be as a secondary benefit treating their stimulant use disorder.
I think that's a great point, Natalie. That becomes an even more complicated discussion, and I totally agree with you. And just to your comment there, Carolyn, I reiterating that psychosocial treatments are the gold standard. We're pretty far down the garden path here when we're starting to talk about medications. This is, you know, certainly not guideline based, and this is still quite novel, and maybe not controversial, but I think that the comfort level that we all have with these medications is rather low, and so referring or seeking some support from somebody with experience in this area, I think, is always a good idea.
I've heard as well a lot about topiramate for treating stimulant use disorders. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you may or may not use that in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, topiramate is one of those medications that comes up a lot, I think, in addiction medicine as a whole. It evokes
possibly all of medicine, like a little bit of topiramate here, there, migraines, headache.
The quintessential adjunct.
No one really knows what it does or how it works, but you're right. This is a medication that comes up often, and I think the data is mixed, I will say. So it comes up most commonly in the context of discussion around cocaine use disorder. So again, rortazapine and the combination of naltrexone on bupropion, that was all done with people who were using crystal meth psychostimulants. The trial that I was referring to, or the meta-analysis, was a combination of the two. Topiramate is most commonly discussed in the context of cocaine use. Mixed evidence there. Really, probably the most compelling evidence that we have for topiramate, which it was another relatively recent study done by Francis Levin out of New York, was looking at a combination of topiramate and Adderall. Or mixed amphetamine salts in combination. And they did a really nice trial there quite recently, a 12-week trial looking at a combination of a slow increase up to 60 milligrams of Adderall and an increase over, I think, 6 weeks of 100 milligrams, up to 100 milligrams BID of topiramate. And again, showed a significant effect there on abstinence, on people with heavier cocaine use. So the data has been quite mixed with topiramate, but that combination, and that was a replication trial of a smaller one that they did previously. That's probably, if you're gonna go down that direction, where I think the money is at this point in time.
Great. So it sounds like there are a number of options that have been studied in terms of medication management. the studies that have been done, you know, are quite complex, I think, to interpret. There are a lot of nuances and sort of caveats that go with them. But I think the take-home point for our listeners is, one, you know, there are medications that may be appropriate, you know, for your patient, and it's important to connect them to an addiction specialist to sort of have that more nuanced discussion. And I think to sort of like close out the night, you know, I would really love to hear about how would you counsel a patient who maybe doesn't want to stop their stimulant use, you know, and you're really taking a harm reduction approach. Like, what strategies do you talk to that individual about to really like help people keep safe if abstinence isn't their goal?
Yeah. And I think this is a critical part of any discussion that we have is you know, for somebody whose goal is just to be safe or to cut down, but not stop. How do we ensure that they're doing so in as safe a manner as possible? There's a few things to touch on. Certainly, route of administration is one that, that we can have a conversation around. Many people have a preferred route of administration, and nothing that I'd say or do is going to change that. But I want to at least make sure that we're having the conversation around safety and ensuring they know that, you know, for instance, most people know that sharing needles is a risk factor for infection, but sharing tubes for insufflation or pipes can also transmit hep C. So ensuring that they're aware, depending on what their preferred route is, about how to do that in as safe as fashion as possible. And then obviously, you know, depending on the clinical scenario, there's, you know, if somebody has extremely advanced COPD, for instance, then we might talk to them about strategies that might keep them out of hospital with another COPD exacerbation or similarity. If somebody's come in with recurrent bloodstream infections or complicated bacteremia, talking about strategies other than injection use might be something to introduce at least as food for thought. So those are some of the kind of bigger items to talk about there. But probably more important than anything is what we've already alluded to earlier is the risk of overdose. And how to make sure that you're protecting yourself against that. We're living in a world that is deeply affected by a toxic drug supply and one that's becoming increasingly volatile and unpredictable. So ensuring that people are taking steps to be safe when they're using is key, including using around people or having a strategy in place in case what you're using is not what you think it is, having Narcan kits around, whether it's a virtual monitoring system. We have, you know, many patients will have phone trees or something to make sure that people are checking on and make sure that they haven't inadvertently overdosed. Just having some strategy in place to make sure that if they do end up coming across fentanyl by accident, that there's a safety net there. Those would be some of the more common things that I would suggest is using around people, using it at an overdose prevention site, which we have many of them here in Vancouver, or at least having Narcan around. There's even apps out there. I don't know if you guys, has anyone heard of Lifeguard? Is that a thing in the US?
I'm not sure if we have Lifeguard, but there is a volunteer-run hotline, a never-use-alone hotline that exists for English and Spanish that you can call that has national volunteers. So I've heard of apps that maybe detect your body movement, but I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about.
That's not the one I was referring to. Is it's more designed for people who use opioids, but again, could be applied elsewhere. It's a timer. You put in an address and you set a timer, and if you don't come back and turn it off, it calls 911 to that address. So that's something that they have here in BC, that if people have an address and a phone, which are sort of the prerequisites there, can be used. But just, you know, whatever strategy you can come up with, given your local resources and context, making sure people are just aware of that risk of overdose, because it's always there, unfortunately.
And in our episode with Dr. Kim Su, we did talk about the Never Use Alone hotline. So we'll make sure to link that in the show notes as well. So I want to thank you so much, you know, Paxton, for spending your evening with us today. Do you have any main take-home points for our listeners?
Yeah, I'll just reiterate. Stimulant use disorders are treatable. We have well evidence-based psychosocial options and a lot of medications that I think are worth considering. So it's important to have this on your radar, because they often get, at least in my experience, written off as less treatable than other substance use disorders. As I mentioned, psychosocial treatments remain the gold standard, but medications are worth considering. Probably one other take home that I think is always worth mentioning is that stimulant use and stimulant use disorder are not the same things. And those often get conflated. Just because somebody uses cocaine sometimes doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a conversation around safety and health implications. But stimulant use and stimulant use disorder are not always one and the same.
And is there anything that you'd like to plug?
I will take this opportunity, knowing that we have a lot of internists and primary care physicians listening. I just want to point out that there's a very pervasive myth out there of unopposed alpha stimulation and a contraindication of beta blocker use in people who use stimulants. It's firmly ingrained in us, I think, in medical training, and there's no really good evidence to support that. So if you have a patient who has a strong indication for a beta blocker, they've had a recent STEMI, or they have significant heart failure, and this is a drug with a potentially life-saving benefit, just because they use stimulants sometimes, that is not a reason to automatically withhold that treatment. So I'll just throw that pearl in for the internists in the crowd.
They're going to love that pearl. I hope it's going to put everyone's mind at ease. We get calls about it. I'm like, it's okay. It's okay to use the beta blocker. It's going to be fine. It is. Trust me. I promise you. They're much bigger fish to fry.
Just hold their hand while they write the order.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It was a real pleasure.
So this has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at thecurbsiders.com. We have worked very hard on them, so please check them out.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmedicine@gmail.com. Special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto, Dr. Paul Williams for their support on this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org.
And as always, a reminder that most episodes are available for free CME for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Natalie Stahl. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you some pearls on SUD.